Acharya Asatara Satashi Shimada Divine Grace Asi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Shila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Nam Acharya Shila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinashai Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Mathura Dham Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai Ganga Mayajuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sanyavani Paskujade Satarane. Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 31st, 2012, Skype class reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 15. The Pandavas retire timely, text 16. Yado Shuma Pranihitam Guru Bhishma Karma. Naptri Trigartha Shalya Sandava Balikadhyay. Astrang Yamoga Mahimani Niruptitani. No pas prashur nrihari na dasami varsurani. Yapt. Under whose? Doshu. Protection of arms. Ma pranihitam. Myself being situated. Guru. Dronacharya. Bhishma. Bhishma. Karna. Karna. Naptri Bhurishrava Trigartha King Shusharma Shalya Shalya Saindvana, King Jayadrath, Balika, brother of Maharaj Shantanu, Bhishma's father. Ajayi. Etc. Ashtrani. Weapons. Amoga. Invincible. Mahimani. Very powerful. Nirupitani. Applied. Na. Not. Upaspruchu. Touched. Nrihari Dasam. Servitor of Nrisingadev Prahlad. Eva. Like. Asurani. Weapons employed by the demons. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. This is again Arjuna speaking about Krishna's glories, especially in relation to himself, and feeling separation from Krishna, who's left the planet. So translation. Great generals like Bhishma, Drona, Karna, Bhurishrava, Susharma, Shalya, Jayadrath, and Balika all directed their invincible weapons against me. But by his, Lord Krishna's grace, they could not even touch a hair on my head. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaj, the supreme devotee of Lord Nrisingadev, was unaffected by the weapons the demons used against him. So this purport is a little long, and it's one of these purports where Srila Prabhupada is describing the persons mentioned in the verse. So he's telling different stories. It's the purport. The history of Prahlad Maharaj, the great devotee of Nrisingadeva, is narrated in the 7th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Prahlad Maharaja's small child of only 5 years became the object of envy for his great father, Hiranyakashipu, only because of his becoming a pure devotee of the Lord. The demon father employed all his weapons to kill the devotee son, Prahlad. But by the grace of the Lord, he was saved from all sorts of dangerous actions by his father. He was thrown into a fire in boiling oil from the top of a hill, underneath the legs of an elephant, and he was administered poison. At last, the father himself took up a chopper to kill his son, and thus Nrisingadev appeared and killed the heinous father in the presence of the son. Thus, no one can kill the devotee of the Lord. Similarly, Arjuna was also saved by the Lord, although all dangerous weapons were employed by his great opponents like Bhishma. So before we go on in the purport, so Arjuna had been mentioning how he was saved from his enemies, Bhishma, Drona, Karna, Bhurishrava, Susharma, Shalya, Jayadrath, and Balika. And he was comparing his being saved by the Lord to the Lord saving Prahlad Maharaj. So Prabhupada was telling a little bit of the, very little bit of the story of Prahlad Maharaj, and particularly how, as a five-year-old child, his life was threatened in so many ways. All right, now Prabhupada is going to tell about Karna. So this is a long section on Karna. And one thing we'll notice as we read through this about Karna is that some of the way Prabhupada's telling the story here may be different from what's described in various editions of the Mahabharata. And just keep in mind that there are 300 different versions of the Mahabharata. They all tell the story somewhat differently. Okay, Prabhupada's talking here. Karna. Born of Kunti by the sun god prior to her marriage with Maharaj Pandu, Karna took his birth with bangles and earrings, extraordinary signs for an undaunted hero. In the beginning, his name was Vasusena, but when he grew up, he presented his natural bangles and earrings to Indradev, and thenceforward he became known as Vaikartana. After his birth from the maiden Kunti, he was thrown into the Ganga. Later, he was picked up by Adirath, and he and his wife Radha brought him up as their own offspring. Karna was very charitable, especially toward the Brahmanas. There was nothing he could not spare for a Brahmana. In the same charitable spirit, he gave in charity his natural bangles and earrings to Indradev, who, being very much satisfied with him, gave him in return a great weapon called Shakti. He was admitted as one of the students of Dronacharya, and from the very beginning there was some rivalry between him and Arjuna. Seeing his constant rivalry with Arjuna, Duryodhan picked him up as his companion, and this gradually grew into greater intimacy. He was also present in the great assembly of Draupadi's Swayamvar function, and when he attempted to exhibit his talent in that meeting, Draupadi's brother declared that Karna could not take part in the competition because of his being the son of a Shudra carpenter. Although he was refused in the competition, still when Arjuna was successful at piercing the fish target on the ceiling and Draupadi bestowed her garland upon Arjuna, Karna and the other disappointed princes offered an unusual stumbling block to Arjuna while he was leaving with Draupadi. Specifically, Karna fought with him very valiantly, but all of them were defeated by Arjuna. Duryodhan was very much pleased with Karna because of his constant rivalry with Arjuna, and when he was in power, he enthroned Karna in the state of Anga. Being baffled in his attempt to win Draupadi, Karna advised Duryodhan to attack King Drupad, who, after defeating him, both Arjuna and Draupadi could be arrested. But Dronacharya rebuked them for this conspiracy, and they refrained from the action. Karna was defeated many times, not only by Arjuna, but also by Bhimasingh. He was the king of the kingdom of Bengal, Orissa, and Madras combined. Later on, he took an active part in the Rajasiya sacrifice of Maharaj Yudhisthira, and when there was gambling between the rival brothers, designed by Shakuni, Karna took part in the game, and he was very pleased when Draupadi was offered as a bet in the gambling. This fed his old grudge. When Draupadi was in the game, he was very enthusiastic to declare the news, and it was he who ordered Dushasan to take away the garments of both the Pandavas and Draupadi. He asked Draupadi to select another husband, because, being lost by the Pandavas, she was rendered a slave of the Kurus. He was always an enemy of the Pandavas, and whenever there was an opportunity, he tried to curb them by all means. During the Battle of Kurukshetra, he foresaw the conclusive result, and he expressed his opinion that due to Lord Krishna's being the chariot driver of Arjuna, the battle should be won by Arjuna. He always differed with Bhishma, and sometimes he was proud enough to say that within 5 days he could finish up the Pandavas if Bhishma would not interfere with his plan of action. But he was much mortified when Bhishma died. He killed Ghatotkacha with the Shakti weapon obtained from Indradev. His son, Vrishasena, was killed by Arjuna. He killed the largest number of Pandava soldiers. At last there was a severe fight with Arjuna, and it was he only who was able to knock off the helmet of Arjuna. But it so happened that the wheel of his chariot stuck in the battlefield mud, and when he got down to set the wheel right, Arjuna took the opportunity and killed him, although he requested Arjuna not to do so. Okay, next person we're looking at is Napta or Bhushrava. Bhushrava was the son of Somadatta, a member of the Kuru family. His older brother was Shalya. Both the brothers and the father attended the Swayamvara ceremony of Draupadi. All of them appreciated the wonderful strength of Arjuna due to his being the devotee friend of the Lord. And thus Bhushrava advised the sons of Dhritarashtra not to pick any quarrel or fight with them. All of them also attended the Rajasuya Yajna of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He possessed one Akshohini regiment of army, cavalry, elephants, and chariots, and all these were employed in the Battle of Kurukshetra on behalf of Duryodhan's party. He was counted by Bhima as one of the Yutapatis. In the Battle of Kurukshetra, he was especially engaged in a fight with Satyaki, and he killed 10 sons of Satyaki. Later on, Arjuna cut off his hands, and he was ultimately killed by Satyaki. After his death, he merged into the existence of Vishvadeva. So Vishvadeva literally means the god of the universe. Okay, next person, Trigartha or Susharma. Son of Maharaj Vidakshetra, he was the king of Trigarthadesh, and he was also present in the Swayamvara ceremony of Draupadi. He was one of the allies of Duryodhan, and he advised Duryodhan to attack the Matsyadesh, Darbhanga. During the time of cow stealing in Viratanagara, he was able to arrest Maharaj Viratha, but later Maharaj Viratha was released by Bhima. In the Battle of Kurukshetra, he also fought very valiantly, but at the end he was killed by Arjuna. Next person, Jayadratha, another son of Maharaj Vridakshetra. He was the king of Sindhu Desha, modern Sindh, Pakistan. His wife's name was Dushala. Now, Prabhupada doesn't say it here, but Dushala was the one of the sisters. She was a sister of Duryodhan and his brothers. So Dushala was the daughter of Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, which makes Jayadratha a brother-in-law to Duryodhan. Okay, going on here. He was also present in the Swayamvara ceremony of Draupadi, and he desired very strongly to have her hand, but he failed in the competition. But since then, he always sought the opportunity to get in touch with Draupadi. When he was going to marry in the Shalyadesh, on the way to Kamyavan, he happened to see Draupadi again and was too much attracted to her. The Pandavas and Draupadi were then in exile after losing their empire and gambling, and Jayadratha thought it wise to send news to Draupadi in an illicit manner through Koti Shashya, one of his associates. Draupadi at once refused vehemently the proposal of Jayadratha, but being so attracted by the beauty of Draupadi, he tried again and again. Every time he was refused by Draupadi, he tried to take her away forcibly on his chariot, and at first Draupadi gave him a good dashing, and he fell like a cut root tree. But he was not discouraged, and he was able to force Draupadi to sit on the chariot. This incident was seen by Domyamuni, and he strongly protested the action of Jayadratha. He also followed the chariot, and through Datrayika, the matter was brought to the notice of Maharaj Yudhisthira. The Pandavas then attacked the soldiers of Jayadratha and killed them all, and at last Bhima caught hold of Jayadratha and beat him very severely, almost dead. Then all but five hairs were cut off his head, and he was taken to all the kings and introduced as the slave of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He was forced to admit himself to be the slave of Maharaj Yudhisthira before all the princely order, and the same condition he was brought before Maharaj Yudhisthira. Maharaj Yudhisthira was kind enough to order him released, and when he admitted to being a tributary prince under Maharaj Yudhisthira, Queen Draupadi also desired his release. After this incident, he was allowed to return to his country. Being so insulted, he went to Gangotri in the Himalayas and undertook a severe type of penance to please Lord Shiva. He asked the benediction to defeat all the Pandavas, at least one at a time. Then the Battle of Kurukshetra began, and he took sides with Duryodhan. In the first day's fight, he was engaged with Maharaj Drupad, then with Virat, and then with Abhimanyu. While Abhimanyu was being killed, mercilessly surrounded by seven great generals, the Pandavas came to his help, but Jayadratha, by the mercy of Lord Shiva, repulsed them with great ability. At this, Arjuna took a vow to kill him. And on hearing this, Jayadratha wanted to leave the war field and ask permission from the Kauravas for this cowardly action, but he was not allowed to do so. On the contrary, he was obliged to fight with Arjuna, and while the fight was going on, Lord Krishna reminded Arjuna that the benediction of Shiva upon Jayadratha was that whoever would cause his head to fall on the ground would die at once. He therefore advised Arjuna to throw the head of Jayadratha directly onto the lap of his father, who was engaged in penances at the Samanta Panchaka pilgrimage. This was actually done by Arjuna. Jayadratha's father was surprised to see a severed head on his lap, and he at once threw it to the ground. The father immediately died, his forehead being cracked in seven pieces. Yado Shuma Pranihitam Guru Bhijmakarna Naptrir Trigartha Shalya Sandava Balikadhyay Astranyamoga Mahimani Niruptitani No Pastrishur Nirharidashamihav Surani. Great generals like Bhijma, Drona, Karna, Bhurishrava, Shusharma, Shalya, Jayadratha, and Balika all directed their invincible weapons against me. But by his, Lord Krishna's grace, they could not even touch a hair on my head. Similarly, Prahlad Maharaja, the supreme devotee of Lord Nrisimhadev, was unaffected by the weapons the demons used against him. So there's so much in this purport. Days and weeks of storytelling. Now let's take a look here at Jayadratha. Jayadratha's an interesting character. So he has a nice wife, Dushala. And, of course, in those days, polygamy was allowed, and especially the kings would have many wives. So he wanted to get another wife, Draupadi. And when he was disappointed in marrying Draupadi, he didn't just say, oh, well, I guess I'm not meant to have her. I guess that's not my destiny. I guess she's not supposed to be my wife. But he maintained an attitude of desire for her. He didn't let go of the desire. And then we find he's going to marry somebody else. He's going to another wedding. He's going to marry in the Shalyadesh. And on the way there, he sees Draupadi. And he thinks, well, maybe I can convince her to come with me now. Maybe I can entice her away from her other husbands. So he has a desire. It's frustrated. And he doesn't give up the desire. And instead, he wants to fulfill his desire in a sinful, criminal way. Even though he already has, who knows how many wives he has at least one and he's going to marry another one, he's still not happy. He's got to have Draupadi also. And he asks her again and again and again and again, she refuses, Prabhupada says. So a gentleman doesn't force something on a woman that she refuses. That's the behavior of a gentleman. Every properly trained young man knows that you don't enjoy a woman if she's not willing. Even in modern society, where there's practically no concept of morality, they do have this idea that sexual relations need to be consensual. At least they have that understanding, that there shouldn't be force. They may not understand very much else, but at least they understand that. But this Jayadrath, he didn't understand this. So uncivilized, less civilized. I mean, in one sense, he's from another age, and he was a great king, but he was less civilized even than the common person today. And he decided, all right, I'm going to kidnap this woman. I'll kidnap her and rape her and steal her from her husband if she's not willing to come with me voluntarily. Of course, that didn't work out very well because Draupadi had 5 powerful husbands, and their guru, Domya, saw this whole thing, and so particularly Bhima, who was famous for protecting Draupadi again and again, he went after Jayadrath and trounced the guy. They killed all of Jayadrath's army, and he beat up Jayadrath within an ounce of his life, practically speaking, and then humiliated him. So I don't know why this haircutting thing was so humiliating to the Kshatriyas, but evidently they took it rather seriously. We have another story, of course, with Rukmi, when he was trying to stop Krishna from kidnapping Rukmini at Rukmini's request. And Krishna, rather than killing Rukmi, because Rukmini said, please don't kill my brother, so Krishna, instead of killing him, he gave him also this kind of haircut where he shaved his head except for a few pieces of hair. And Rukmi felt like he had been killed, that his honor was... Of course, these Kshatriyas are really into their honor and their prestige. That's their main interest. That's their main motivator. And they want honor and prestige for being righteous. And it's not that they just want any kind of fame. They want fame as a righteous person. And this is considered to be defamed, to have your hair cut like this. And not only was his hair cut in a funny way, same thing like Rukmi, just these little pieces of hair, 5 little pieces of hair, Prabhupada says. But also, Jayadrath was brought before Yudhisthira. You've got to remember, Yudhisthira was at this time in exile. So he had had the Rajasuya sacrifice to establish him as the world emperor, but now he had lost his kingdom and he's living in exile for 13 years. And this Jayadrath was forced to declare that he was a subservient king. And when Draupadi saw that Jayadrath was saying that he was subservient to Yudhisthira, then she was willing to let him go. She felt this was enough punishment for him. Of course, he didn't take this subservience very seriously, because he fought on the side of Duryodhan. So he was really, this Jayadrath was not, even from a completely mundane point of view, he didn't have much morality. The Kshatriyas, they might marry many women, and they might even have relationships with maidservants or concubines, but they didn't steal somebody else's wife. And if they vowed loyalty to someone, they kept it. And we find that Jayadrath doesn't keep it. He vows loyalty to Yudhisthira, obviously under duress, but still he made the vow to keep his life. But instead he fights on the side of Duryodhan. And then after all of this, he doesn't realize that he's done anything wrong. It doesn't occur to him that he's done something wrong. Rather, he thinks that the Pandavas have done something wrong by humiliating him, by cutting his hair, and by making him subservient to Yudhisthira. And therefore, his mood is to vow revenge. So he does some severe austerity. It says elsewhere in Bhagavatam that he was eating a handful of ashes every day for a year and worshipping Shiva. And Shiva waited a year to come before him. No, that was someone else. So eventually Shiva came before him because of his severe austerities and said, "What do you want?" And Jayadra says, "I want to defeat all the Pandavas." And Lord Shiva says, "Well, that's not possible. They're protected by Krishna." And Jayadratha said, "Well, at least I want to be able to keep each Pandava individually at bay for one day, you know, not to kill them." He kind of had to ask for a reduced benediction. And Lord Shiva said, "All right, for any four of the Pandavas, not all five of them." So that's what Jayadratha was able to do. And it's sort of interesting. The Kurus engineered this circle formation, which only Arjuna knew how to break in and out of, at a time when Arjuna was going to be taken away from that area of the battle. In fact, by, someone else mentioned this verse, Trigarta. So Trigarta or Susharma, he enticed Arjuna to another area of the battlefield where the main Kuru army in the main area had set up this circle formation, thinking that in this way they could capture Mara's Yudhisthira. That was their goal. And instead of that, they ended up capturing Abhimanyu, who knew how to break into the circle formation but didn't know how to break out. And when he went into the circle formation, the other four Pandava brothers went to offer him support. And Jayadrath, because of this benediction of Lord Shiva, was able to prevent them from offering support. And therefore, Abhimanyu was killed unfairly by, I forget, six or seven Maharatis at once. Now, what's very interesting here is that Arjuna did not vow vengeance on the Maharatis who unfairly killed Abhimanyu, because it was supposed to, the Kshatriyas were supposed to fight fairly. That way, the whoever wins was actually considered the most righteous, a fight between equals. Everything had to be on equal ground. And he didn't take a vow against these Maharatis who ganged up on Abhimanyu. Rather, he took a vow against Jayadratha, who prevented the contest from becoming equal. Jayadratha kept the other Pandavas from helping Abhimanyu. So Arjuna felt that the real fault here was on Jayadratha rather than these other attackers. And he took a vow. He said, "I'm going to kill Jayadratha by the sunset tomorrow. I'm going to give up my life." And as Prabhupada mentions here, Jayadratha got so scared that he wanted to run away from the battlefield. So we see that Jayadratha is really, he's not a high-class Kshatriya. You know, to want to kidnap and rape another man's wife, to take a vow of loyalty to a king and then break it, to just be interested in vengeance, to run away from the battlefield due to cowardice. So all these things indicate that he wasn't on a high level of Kshatriya, even on a materialistic level. And then Krishna tells Arjuna that Jayadratha has this benediction that if anybody kills him, he'll die. Specifically, if anyone makes his head fall to the ground. So Arjuna was able to send Jayadratha's head all the way to the lap of his father, and that way kill both Jayadratha and his father when the father put the head on the ground. And Jayadratha really exemplifies a very materialistic mentality. You know, that seeing if there's a conflict with someone else, thinking that we're the victim, even if from an objective point of view, we're actually the perpetrator. So you see, right along here, Jayadratha keeps thinking of himself as the victim. You know, I should have won Draupadi. Draupadi really belongs to me. I deserve to have Draupadi. Instead of just acknowledging, okay, there's a better man that got her and she's married to somebody else. And when she says no to him later, again, he thinks, well, I'm just the victim. I should be able to have whatever I want. And when he vows loyalty to Yudhisthira, you know, I'm sure he had some sort of rationalization where I vowed loyalty under duress. I wasn't really vowing loyalty, so I can fight against him in the battle. And when Lord Shiva tells him you can't get what you really want, then instead of just accepting that and saying, well, okay, you know, that's not meant to be, he tries to get what he wants anyway. Something like Hiranyakashipu, who's told you can't get what you want, and he tries to get it anyway in some other way. And of course, he doesn't actually achieve his desired goal. And in this way, he wastes his life. So this is the way materialistic people, they take their life and they're wrapped up and this is what I want. I deserve to get it. If there's some kind of conflict, everyone else is at fault, and I'm the victim, and I'm, you know, I'm going to destroy my enemies, and I'm going to get what I want at any cost. And although Jayadrath may be an extreme case of this, so the majority of people don't go around trying to rape other men's wives or breaking their promises, but still, the basic mentality that Jayadrath has is present in all materialistic people. That I deserve everything. Everything I want, I also deserve. And everything that I want and I deserve, I should be able to get at any cost. And anyone who stands away of what I want and I deserve, I can defeat in some way. I can lie to them. I can cheat them. I can force them. I can do anything that I want, basically, to get what I want. So that's the mentality we see here in Jayadrath. Now, going to a little bit higher mentality, let's go up to Karna, who's a very interesting and somewhat enigmatic person. So first of all, Karna really gets a bad start in life. You know, he's actually half demigod, and Kunti herself is part Naga. So he's born from divine parents. Kunti's a very highly qualified person. Spiritually, she's a pure devotee of the Lord. Materially, she's a great princess. Later on, she becomes the queen and the empress herself. What to speak of the sun god? That one can say Indra is the chief god or Brahma is the chief god, but also one may say the sun god is the chief god, that he's giving light, and as we chant in the Brahma Gayatri, enlightenment to the universe. He's certainly the sun god and the moon god are certainly the heads of the Kshatriya clans on earth, the king of kings. The sun god is also associated with Lord Ramachandra, the supreme king of all of the planets. So Karna is has such a parentage. And yet, although he has by birth, by genetics, I mean, he has such a divine body that he's born with jewelry. So what baby is born with jewelry? And still, by circumstances of fate, although he has this parentage, he's raised by a low-class person, as Prabhupada says, or a carpenter, or sometimes we hear just some sort of a servant. So by birth, he was considered a Shudra. And he really had a hard time dealing with this situation. He had the mood of a Kshatriya, he had the inclinations of a Kshatriya, but he wasn't so much accepted like that by the society. And he also had a high envy of people who had a better position than he had. So this is also typical of a materialistic person, that if someone has something better than me, I envy them. And he was particularly envious of Arjuna, that Arjuna was, frankly, a better warrior than he was. As Prabhupada says here, Karna was defeated many times by Arjuna in many different circumstances, and he couldn't bear it. He wanted to have some position. Of course, it's natural for Kshatriya. Kshatriya has Ishvara Bhav, which I was reading the other day in a purport, means the inclination to want to protect others, to want to take care of others. You know, we tend to think that that's just a negative quality, to want to be a leader and take care of others. But that is actually a wonderful quality for a king. So he had this kind of quality, but he unfortunately also had this envy. And it really destroyed him. Because he was envious of Arjuna, he made friends, as Prabhupada said in here, with Duryodhan, and conspired against Arjuna over and over again. He also, like Jayadrath, never really could accept the fact that Draupadi was married to someone else. You know, he just, somehow or other, I'm going to get back at Draupadi for choosing Arjuna as her husband. And to the point that he also lost his higher human behavior, being happy that Draupadi was gambled, as Prabhupada says here, suggesting that she be disrobed, telling Draupadi that now you're a slave, you should choose another husband, and so forth. Of course, it's interesting here that Karna, definitely being a higher class person than Jayadrath, Prabhupada says here he was able to understand that because Krishna was on the side of the Pandavas, that they were going to win. How does he say that here? He saw, it said, during the battle of Kurukshetra, he foresaw the conclusive result, and he expressed his opinion that due to Lord Krishna's being the chariot driver of Arjuna, the battle should be won by Arjuna. So although he can understand that, still he sucked to Duryodhan. But he did have the ability, at least, to see that Krishna was going to win. And it's also interesting that Prabhupada says here that he was differing with Bhishma, but yet he was very sad when Bhishma left. So his differing with Bhishma was on a sportive level. And Krishna arranged that Karna was killed by unfair means. That Karna was killed when his chariot wheel was stuck in the mud. Why? Because Karna himself had used so many unfair and adharmic means to try to get what he wanted in his life. So we also have here the example of Hiranyakashipu with Prahlad Maharaj, similar kind of person who just, I want what I want at any cost, and anyone who gets in my way, even my son, I'm going to get rid of them. So these are negative examples in the scripture of how not to misuse our valuable human energy. That we see that these personalities who were intelligent, learned, powerful, wealthy, so many things. But because they couldn't control their mind and their senses, just like Prahlad Maharaj said to his father Hiranyakashipu, your real enemy is your mind and your senses. Because they couldn't understand the actual way to be happy in life, everything led to frustration. These were not happy people. Karna had many good qualities. As Prabhupada says here, he was so charitable that he gave up his natural jewelry to Indra. He was a very, very giving person. But still, he was not happy. He was always wanting something more. Now, none of these people were able to accept that when there were reverses in life, that was the will of God, that it was the will of their destiny, and learn to be happy anyway. No, they were constantly trying to manipulate the world to get them what they want. And consequently, they were defeated. Whereas we find, by contrast, Arjuna doesn't have that mentality at all. Arjuna's mentality is just, let me make Krishna happy, and whatever Krishna gives me is all right. When Arjuna was in exile, his mood wasn't, oh, we're just going to do anything we can to get back at these people. In fact, when it was time for the battle, Arjuna said, I really don't want to fight. Never mind that these people are greedy and avaricious. So what? Why should I be like them? If they want the kingdom, let them have it. I'll just become a beggar. And Krishna says, no, do it to make me happy. And then finally Arjuna says, all right, I'll fight for your pleasure, Krishna. So that was the mood of Arjuna. For Arjuna, he's happy pleasing Krishna, whether it means that he's running the world, whether it means that he's pretending to be a brahmana when they ran away from the house of Lak, whether it means that they're living in exile in the forest with the sages. Those things were of no consequence to him. His happiness was just to please Krishna. And whatever part Krishna wanted him to play was all right. Arjuna had to be a eunuch for a year. And he didn't think, now I've become humiliated and my life is over and I have to get vengeance. He wasn't like that. When Urvasi and the heavenly planets cursed him to be a eunuch, he just accepted. Okay, mother, whatever you want. Reminding us of Chitraketu when Parvati cursed him to become a demon. But someone like Jayadrath, when he's punished, and leniently punished, he should have been killed for what he did, but when he was punished by the Pandavas, instead of accepting it, he vowed vengeance. Arjuna was unjustly cursed and he accepted, and Jayadrath was justly punished and he didn't accept. And Arjuna could understand, whatever happens to me, it's the will of Krishna. And he saw a way, to use a modern expression, to make lemonade out of his lemons. And say, all right, well, I'll use this benediction. I'll use this curse as a benediction. That for the year of being incognito, I can hide as a eunuch dance teacher. So this is the difference between the devotee and the materialist. And Arjuna, even now that Krishna's left and he's lost these things, He's lamenting that Krishna's gone. He's not lamenting that he's lost these things. Whether Arjuna has the ability to fight off all of his enemies or not, that's not what he's relishing. He's relishing Krishna's kindness, Krishna's love, Krishna's protection. And therefore, he's always in transcendental ecstasy. Whereas these other people, they can have power, they can have, but they're never satisfied. They always think they deserve more. They always think they should get more. They're willing to take up known losing causes. Karna's fighting a known losing battle to get what he wants. He knows he's going to be defeated. I mean, does Jayadrath really think he's going to kidnap Draupadi from her five husbands? So what kind of path do we want to take? I mean, you know, we can look at these materialists and think they're far below us, or we can look at Arjuna and feel that he's far above us. But really, Pandita Samadarshinaha, we're all equal souls. And if we're a materialist, then we're the same as Jayadratha, Karna, or Hiranyakashipu. We may be on a very small scale, like Prabhupada said, you know, stealing a diamond or stealing a cucumber. But the mentality is the same. And if we're actually a devotee of Krishna, we may be nothing compared to Arjuna, who could astonish even the demigods. But we have the capacity, like Arjuna, to be fully happy in Krishna's pleasure rather than our material arrangements. So it's not that these personalities in the Bhagavatam, I mean, in one sense, they're in another age. They have powers beyond what we can imagine. You know, we don't see any children being born now from the demigods with natural jewelry. So we may feel that we can't relate to them. But the basic psychology is the same. You know, the psychology even of the demigods, whatever, it's not really that there's a radically different psychology. You know, how do we act when things don't go our way? How do we act when someone else gets something that we want? How do we act when we do something wrong and we get in trouble for it? How do we act when we are unjustly punished? How do we act when the people in our lives don't cooperate with us? You know, how do we behave? Do we behave like Jayadrath, or do we behave like Karna? Or do we behave like Hiranyakashipu, or do we behave like Arjuna? Where do we want to go? What kind of person do we want to be? So we're making these decisions at every moment. And it's not just that, well, I can't help acting like a demon, you know, someday when I magically become a pure devotee, then I won't act like that anymore. I mean, on one level, perhaps that's true. But on another level, the way that Krishna is going to give us his grace to take us to pure devotional service is to do our very best, and we may fail in so many ways, but to do our very best to emulate Arjuna and not Karna, not Jayadrath, not Hiranyakashipu. How do you know? I may have smaller things going on in my life, but how do I respond? So, of course, as I said, we could talk. I didn't even talk about some of these personalities. We could certainly talk at great length. I really like these sections in the first canto where Prabhupada describes each of these personalities almost like a little mini encyclopedia. So anybody have questions, comments?
Personalities like Jayadrath that almost insanely were driven to try to achieve something, accomplish something that was just not possible, it's not in their cards, not in their karma.
Right.
So as devotees, we certainly understand that we should not be mad after achieving various material things, but spiritually, where do we draw the line if we're desiring something spiritual, some service to serve Krishna or Prabhupada in some capacity, but yet it's just not working out? How far do we endeavor before we fall into the parameters of where Rupa Goswami talks about adhyahara priyashascha pachapunyamagraha? Janasangas chalya lolyam cha Kshatriya Bhakti or Vaishnava, how do we determine when to stop endeavoring and, okay, this is Krishna's plan. Krishna just doesn't want me to do this.
That's a really interesting question. On one level, our actual spiritual aspiration is to please Krishna. And we should certainly want to please Krishna no matter what. There shouldn't be ahoituki apritiyata. You know, it's not that there should be any obstacle where we're saying, okay, I'm not going to try to please Krishna now. You know, I give up. It's just not in the cards. It's just not my destiny. I'm just not meant to please Krishna. So in that sense, we should be as determined to please Krishna as Jayadrath was to get Draupadi. As Jayadrath was to get Draupadi or to get his prestige or something like that. As far as specific things we want to do for Krishna, the point is that we're trying to please Krishna. The point is not that we're trying to do this or that. We're not ultimately attached to the particular service. We're attached to Krishna being happy with us. So if Krishna asks us to do one thing and then asks us to do something else, I mean, look at this thing with Yudhisthira and Arjuna, where Yudhisthira was performing the Rajasuya Yajna. You know, he asked Krishna. He says, I really want to perform the Rajasuya Yajna. And the reason Yudhisthira gave, he said, I want to do this Rajasuya Yajna so people can see the result of worshipping you and the result of not worshipping you. I want people in the world to see that those who worship you are successful. So he does this Rajasuya Yajna. It took a long time. It took about a year or so to go to all the kings of the world and get them to submit to Yudhisthira or else fight. And then they had to fight with Jarasandhar. And then, of course, you have to get all the money together. Arjuna went to get the money from a former sacrifice. And they had to build all kinds of, I assume, temporary residences for everybody coming. It was a huge, expensive, and complex endeavor. So they do this Rajasuya Yajna, and Maharaj Yudhisthira is the emperor of the world, and Krishna's given his permission, and Krishna's given his happiness, and Krishna's right there, and everything's wonderful. And then there's this gambling match, and Maharaj Yudhisthira loses everything. And then there he is in exile for 13 years. So the devotees are willing to say, Krishna, you can use me to be the world emperor, and tomorrow you can use me to be a pauper in exile. And I'm willing to do both, as you like. And then again, Maharaj Yudhisthira was again enthroned. You know, I'm willing to fight the war for you, Krishna. And then Maharaj Yudhisthira didn't want to take over. He said, you know, I'm ruling the kingdom at the expense of all of these people and animals and so much killing. And once he understood from Bhishma that it was Krishna's desire, then again he was willing to accept that. So first of all, the mentality of the devotee is not that I'm attached to doing this or that particular thing for Krishna. The mentality of the devotee is I'm attached to making Krishna happy. So then the question becomes, well, how do I know if an obstacle means that Krishna is telling me to do something else, or if the obstacle is a test of my determination to do this thing? I basically boil it down to that. Because when we try to do things to please Krishna, there are definitely obstacles. Undoubtedly. And what do they mean? Is it a sign that the road is washed out and I'm supposed to take a detour, or as they say here in Europe, a diversion? Or does it mean that I'm supposed to, you know, pound through the blockade, smash it to smithereens? We see Srila Prabhupada in Jhansi, that when the governor's wife wanted the property he was using as a temple, that Prabhupada tried to oppose it, and then he saw, oh, this is not going to work, it's the government's wife, and he acquiesced. Whereas years later, with the property in Juhu, when Mr. Nair had sold the same property to many persons, that Srila Prabhupada kept fighting, and kept fighting, and kept fighting, and kept fighting. And at one point, Prabhupada said, If Krishna had told me that Mr. Nair was a cheater, I wouldn't have bought the property. So Krishna didn't tell me that he was a cheater because Krishna wanted this property. I said, how do we know? Well, Prabhupada says that if we're very much in the mode of goodness, that Krishna becomes one's direct advisor. So then one knows, what does Krishna want? Well, just like the cowherd boys, they were told by Krishna, beg from the brahmanas, and they came back and said it didn't work, and Krishna said, well, go back and beg from the brahmanas' wives. Krishna didn't say, give up. Don't beg from anybody. So Krishna is your direct advisor, but of course that is only going to be the case when one is clear, once one consciousness is clear through coming to sattva-guna, that there's no static on the line. You know, Krishna would love to be our direct advisor, but we've got a lot of static on the line. So then what do we do? All right, so we may have a direct personal order from our spiritual master, but most of us are not in a situation where our spiritual master is giving us very specific guidance for every little detail. And in fact, generally, after somebody is moved out of the brahmachari ashram, then the guru is not saying to them anymore, okay, at 9 o'clock I want you to wash the deity's plates, and at 9:15 I want you to sweep the floor, and at 9:30 I want you to take out the rubbish. You know, we're not usually getting that kind of instruction. So how do you know? And what I've come up with myself is something that I see as very practical. I have like a little flow chart. So the first thing is that when you look at the obstacle, is it possible to surmount the obstacle? Is that even possible? Is it, you know, if you get a diagnosis of terminal cancer and you're going to die in 2 weeks, is there any treatment available? Does the treatment even exist? Just like with Prahlad and Hiranyakashipu, what was Prahlad supposed to do about Hiranyakashipu's torturing? I mean, we're reading about these torturing. You know, poisoning him, fire, boiling oil. So sometimes there's a situation where there just isn't a counteracting force available. It just isn't available to you. So if it isn't available, then you say, all right, this is a detour sign. Krishna wants me to do, either Krishna wants me to do something else, or Krishna wants me to do this in another way, or Krishna wants me to do this later. You know, I've had situations where I tried to do some service that I know Srila Prabhupada wanted done, and it looked like everything was happening, and then everything collapsed, and it was 10 years later before there was another opportunity. So sometimes it's just not right now, or not in this way. And you can explore, you know, is Krishna saying, don't do this at all, don't do this now, or don't do this like this. So then let's say there's an obstacle that you can get rid of. Then you have to ask if your means of getting rid of the obstacle is legal, moral, and ethical. You know, maybe you've been imprisoned in Siberian labor camps for distributing Prabhupada's books, and maybe you could get out if you killed all the guards. You know, but that's an option. You have a way of surmounting the obstacle, but your way of surmounting the obstacle is immoral or illegal or unethical. And then again, you have to take it that this is the will of Krishna. Either I'm not supposed to do this at all, or I'm not supposed to do this now, or I'm not supposed to do this in this way. So then let's say that you have a way of counteracting your situation, and that way is legal, moral, and ethical. Then the next question to ask is this way of counteracting the obstacle going to increase my dependence on Krishna? Is it going to increase my quantity or quality of japa? Is it going to increase my reading? Is it going to increase my humility? Or is it opposed to Krishna consciousness? So there may be a way of counteracting the obstacle that's legal, moral, and ethical, but it's going to destroy you spiritually. Maybe it means you've got to work 20 hours a day and you don't have any time to chant anymore. Maybe it means you have to be arrogant and nasty and step on people's heads. So if you have a means of counteracting an obstacle that increases your Krishna consciousness, that increases your dependence on Krishna, that increases your humility, that increases your respectful dealings with other devotees, and is not violating legal, moral, or ethical norms, then you know that Krishna is just testing your determination.
Yeah, right.
Any other question?
Well, I was just going to say, fantastic class. I love the way you told those pastimes and they related to our lives. That's something that's not so easy to do, but you did it masterfully.
Hare Krishna.
And unless anybody else has a question, I want to remind everybody that's on the
question on Mother Irmala's answer to my question. You're talking about, she just cited an example, just found it, it just kind of interestingly spurred a question in my mind when you were mentioning the hypothetical example that if someone were imprisoned in a communist country for distributing Prabhupada's books, he said, but they could get out by, you know, killing guards. I don't know, I thought maybe, sort of crossed my mind, that doesn't sound like an unreasonable option based on the circumstances. If you could kill the guards and you had been imprisoned for, you know, for those reasons, would morality, you know, mundane morality come into play if you could literally kill the guards and get out?
Well, I'd say be really, really careful. You know, on the one hand, if we have to choose between mundane morality and spiritual morality, we choose the spiritual. In fact, that was Karna's problem, one of his problems. When Karna understood that Krishna was God, he decided that he was more interested in his promise of loyalty to Duryodhan than in surrender to Krishna. You know, I mean, Jayadrath didn't even care about mundane morality. He didn't even care that he'd made a promise of loyalty to Yudhisthira. Karna was very interested in mundane morality, and he chose it over the spiritual. But we're not really talking about choosing mundane morality over the spiritual. You know, can you serve Krishna in a Soviet labor camp? The answer is yes. You know, there's no reason to violate the lower principles of religion if it's possible for you to be Krishna conscious in the circumstances that you're in. And frankly, it's possible to be Krishna conscious really in any situation. I mean, the only time you're going to violate lower principles is if you're absolutely sure, you've really got to be sure, that you're working for Krishna's pleasure.
There's an example that a devotee's told me in the former Soviet Union to manage to bring Prabhupada's books in through the border. They would have to bribe the border guard with bottles of vodka. And so they were able to get them in. I mean, was that not right? Or maybe it shouldn't have been done?
I don't know. I don't really want to judge other people's particular situation for them without knowing all the situation or what I might do in that particular situation. You know, and there are certainly times, particularly when it came to preaching, where we would violate the law. Like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu violated the law of the Qazi. And we would regularly violate the law to distribute Prabhupada's books. So, you know, is it, the question is, you know, is it possible to please Guru and Krishna without breaking ethics, morality? I mean, because where does ethics and morality come from? It comes from Krishna. So obviously it's something that Krishna wants to be followed.
But there is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, "Sarvaram bahidoshena dume nagnya ivaprita," that all material activity is covered with some fault. And then Prabhupada, the purport, says that, you know, sometimes, for example, in business, you one has to hide his profit or deal on the black market.
That's true. Nobody can be perfectly ethical in this world. That's impossible. That doesn't mean that one should be intentionally unethical beyond what's necessary for basic survival. Just like you can't be totally nonviolent. It's not possible. It's impossible to be totally nonviolent. But you don't want to be violent beyond what's unavoidable. So the fault in, that's inherent in all material work is unavoidable fault. That if I'm following the Shastra and I'm doing my duty, there's, I can't escape it. But not to intentionally add to that. Does that make sense? I mean, there are certainly times when we have to violate a lower principle for a higher principle. And this is what's explained in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 9.30, Apichet Chitsuracharo, where Srila Prabhupada in that purport defines an abominable activity in a very interesting way. He says we have two duties, constitutional and conditional. The constitutional is the activities of the soul and conditional is the activities of our psychophysical nature. And he says that generally these two parallel each other. And the reason that they parallel each other, which he doesn't say this there, but the reason they parallel each other is they're both given by Krishna. Krishna's giving us both our constitutional duties and our conditional duties. The Shastra deals with both, deals with the duties of the body and mind and deals with the duties directly of the soul. So generally they're going to parallel one another. But occasionally, Prabhupada says, they become in opposition to one another. And when they oppose one another, the devotee chooses the constitutional over the conditional. In doing so, you may sometimes do something which, by material standards, is abominable. And the example that I always use is that many of us, to join the Hare Krishna movement, had to disobey our parents, which may not mean much in Western culture, but in a civilized culture, disobeying your parents was abominable. I mean, my father wanted me to be a devotee, but my mother didn't. And if I had obeyed my mother, I mean, the Pandavas obeyed their mother, that when she said, whatever alms you have, share it, you know. But when my mother said, don't move in the temple, I said, I'm going to move in anyway. I'm not going to follow your instruction. Again, we don't think of that as something abominable, but it is. So that's my understanding, that sometimes, and it should be really sometimes, there's going to be a situation where one has to violate the lower principle for the higher, but it's unusual. Certainly, we should not sacrifice the higher for the lower. That was Karna's mistake. Karna really made a mistake there. That Krishna personally said to him, you know, come fight with the Pandavas. And Karna said, I know you're going to win, Krishna, but I promised Duryodhana I'm fighting with him, and that's it. And it was a very serious mistake. It would have been better for Karna to have been criticized for breaking his vow than for him not to surrender to Krishna, but he didn't see it like that. Out of his own pride. But generally speaking, you know, 99% of the time, pleasing Krishna is going to include following morals and ethics. You know, for the gopis, when Krishna tells them, go home and serve your husbands, they say no. But the wives of the Brahmins, Krishna gives, it's almost the identical verse. And they do it. And Prabhupada said, you know, all honest women should follow this. So if you actually hear Krishna's flute, then, you know, go for it. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai, thank you, Mataji. All glories to